Krita agasaha, having committed offenses. Deha udbhavena, produced from your body. Alam alam, enough. Kujanmana, with a contemptible birth. Vrida, shame. Mama, my. Abhut, was. Kujan prasangataha, from a relationship with a bad person. Tat janma, that birth. Dhik, shameful. Yah, who. Mahatam, of the great personalities. Avidyakrit, an offender. Translation: you are an offender at the lotus feet of Lord Shiva, and unfortunately I have a body produced from yours. I'm very much ashamed of our bodily relationship, and I condemn myself because my body is contaminated by a relationship with a person who is an offender at the lotus feet of the greatest personality. Please repeat. You are an offender.
You are an offender.
At the lotus feet of Lord Shiva.
At the lotus feet of Lord Shiva.
And unfortunately,
I have a body
produced from yours. I'm very much ashamed. Of our bodily relationship. And I condemn myself.
Because my body is contaminated.
By a relationship with a person
who is an offender
at the lotus feet of the greatest personality. Purport by Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Lord Shiva is the greatest of all the devotees of Lord Vishnu. It is stated, Vaishnava Nam Yatha Shambhu. Shambhu, Lord Shiva is the greatest of all devotees of Lord Vishnu. In the previous verses, Sati has described that Lord Shiva is always in a transcendental position because he is situated in pure Vasudeva. Vasudeva is that state from which Krishna, Vasudev, is born. So Lord Shiva is the greatest devotee of Lord Krishna, and Sati's behavior is exemplary because no one should tolerate blasphemy against Lord Vishnu or his devotee. Sati is aggrieved not for her personal association with Lord Shiva, but because her body is related with that of Daksha, who is an offender at Lord Shiva's lotus feet. She feels herself to be condemned because of the body given by her father Daksha. Om Agyante Mirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamahyam Tadati Swapadantikam Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. So, as we see in this text, the situation is becoming very intense. Sati is actually so offended with her father's behavior towards Lord Shiva that she is now actually considering herself to be very condemned because she's born out of that body, that she's ashamed of the fact that she is the daughter of Daksha. So as we know, in the past, Lord Shiva was insulted in so many different ways by Daksha. I mean, such kind of personal and biting insults that an ordinary person would not be able to take them and would become very disturbed. But Lord Shiva, because of his exalted position and because of always being absorbed in Krishna so much, that it did not matter to him. And he had left that assembly of Daksha very quietly without retaliating in any way. So, and Daksha had pointed out that you are a person who is so shabbily dressed, you live in moratoriums, and you You have snakes around your body, and you are filthy and unclean, and you've got hobgoblins and ghosts as your disciples, and you don't even have a residence. So from a material perspective, all these things could be very valid, but Lord Shiva was not on a material plane. He was an exalted devotee of Krishna. So for him, they're actually very good qualities. The fact that he doesn't have a residence means that he's very detached. And the fact that he is living in moratoriums is to give mercy. It actually indicates his compassion to the extent that he's willing to go and live in places like moratoriums where hobgoblins and ghosts would live, so that he can give them mercy and he can associate with them, and he dresses accordingly. So such is his compassion that he goes to such places and lives with these hobgoblins, and they are in a miserable condition of life because they don't have a body. They're ghosts and spirits. So to elevate them, he's so kind and compassionate that he goes and joins them and he lives with them, and then gradually he uplifts them to the path of bhakti and devotion. Lord Shiva, so such is his exalted position. So then Mother Sati, when she had actually originally not obeyed the instructions of Lord Shiva, and she had left her home and she came to her father's place, she had given all sorts of reasons that she wants to be with her family, and she saw all those beautiful planes flying in the sky, her sisters, her cousins, all dressed up very beautifully in fabulous dresses and ornaments, and she felt tempted to go also. And in spite of Lord Shiva's advice that it will not have good consequences, so please refrain from doing so, yet she proceeded. Of course, she was tempted to go and meet her sisters and her mother, and she also wanted to be part of this big festival, this grand ceremony, which was being held at her father's place. So we see that although she had all these reasons, but once she actually got there, she didn't seem to involve herself much with enjoying the festivities. She even did not take the gifts that her mother and sisters are offering her, as Srila Prabhupada mentions, that she actually first notices that there is no share of offerings for Lord Shiva. And that really upsets her. So immediately she gets on the case of Daksha, because he had offended Lord Shiva in the past, and now Daksha was offending Shiva again by not having any share of the offering. And of course, he had not invited Lord Shiva for the yajna. So Sati has given various reasons, as you know, that Lord Shiva has no enemies, and you are finding faults in a person who's completely faultless, and he has always been very compassionate to all living entities, and yet you are finding faults in him. So then Sati is now very disturbed that her own father is not respecting her husband, who not only happens to be her husband but also is an exalted devotee. So Srila Prabhupada in the purport mentions that Sati's behavior, although it's quite inappropriate to use such derogatory words towards your own father, where she's saying that I'm ashamed of being your daughter. But he clarifies, he says Sati's behavior is exemplary because she was not here, the person in question here is not an ordinary person, but the topmost Vaishnava. So in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, it is mentioned that Gopakumara, when he actually goes looking for the topmost devotee of Krishna, he travels everywhere and he meets many saints and sages, and he also meets Lord Shiva, and then he meets the gopis as well. But it is mentioned that within this material realm, within this material world, Lord Shiva is the topmost devotee. The other devotees, like the gopis who are even higher than him, are actually in the spiritual world. They're not in the material world. So within this material world, he is the most exalted devotee of the Lord. So therefore, his blasphemy definitely has to be condemned and he has to be put to task. So therefore, it is mentioned that there are three ways that you can deal with the blasphemer. You can cut his tongue, you can leave the place, you can give up your own body. So Srila Prabhupada recommends that for us devotees, it is better that we do not associate with such persons, and we actually leave such a place where such blasphemous environments exist or such words are being used against devotees. And it is actually so serious that it is mentioned that when Haridas Thakur was brought to Kazi, you see, West Bengal was ruled by the Muslims, and Haridas Thakur happened to be a Muslim who started chanting the holy names of Krishna. And he was brought to the Kazi, and the Kazi was actually blaspheming the Lord. And he gave all sorts of arguments that why he would continue to chant the holy names of Lord, but the Kazi was extremely upset with him. And then he ordered him to be beaten in 22 marketplaces. So they took him and they beat him in 22 marketplaces. And then the soldiers were worried. They said, oh, he's not dying. And if he doesn't die, then the Qazi will harm us and the Qazi will harm our families. So to show compassion on those soldiers, Haridas Thakur pretended that he was dead. He stopped breathing. So they threw him in the Ganga. And a few kilometers down, he came out and he was again chanting and the glories of the holy names of the Lord. And so the Brahmanas mentioned to him, they said, oh, they felt sorry for him. They said, look, the Qazi has been very unfair to you, that he has punished you so severely for chanting the holy names of the Lord. But he says, no, this was not enough, because the Qazi was blaspheming the Lord, and I should have actually either cut his tongue or I should have killed myself because I did not die. So just these beatings in 22 marketplaces were just a token reaction. They should have done more to me because I have tolerated the blasphemy of the Lord. So this is why it is considered that blasphemy of the Lord or his devotees is a serious offense. And Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur also mentions in Bhaktaloka that any statement that is made out of anger or envy or out of bodily conception of life, then such a person is actually an offender at the lotus feet of Bhakti Devi, devotion personified. So as devotees, we must be very careful, because we don't want to offend Bhakti Devi, because she is the one who's helping us, and we are trying to progress in our devotional lives, not go backwards. So then what happens further down is that Mother Sati, actually considering herself to be the lowest, she actually decides to give up her life, and she gives up her life. She invokes the fire inside of her and she burns herself in that fire. But then, because she is the eternal consort of Lord Shiva, she again takes birth as the daughter of Himalayas. So she's called Parvati. So in this way, Lord Shiva and Parvati, or Sati, the eternal consort of Lord Shiva, they're always together. And they are also an instrument in helping the Lord in his pastimes. And also they play a major role in the creation of the material universes. And also Lord Shiva as Rudra is the one who actually orchestrates the whole annihilation at the time when the material worlds have to be wound up and everything goes back into Mahavishnu's body. So how this happens is that when the Lord Mahavishnu is lying in the causal oceans, in the Karnadakshay oceans, then he's in Yog Nidra. And while he's breathing, from his breathing come out a lot of bubbles, which are the universes. And within himself, he's actually enjoying with his consort Ramadevi. So while he's doing that, then there are two desires that come to his mind. He's thinking, all these living entities that are inside of me, they are in susukti, they are in dormant condition. I wish I could give them the taste of spiritual bliss. He's thinking like that. And the other thing that occurs to his mind, the other desire that he has, is that my consort Rama Devi has an expansion, Chaya Devi, and I wish I could give her some service. So Rama Devi, being always at the service of the Lord, she knows his heart because he is her Lord and Master. So immediately she thinks of a plan. Then she creates then Shambhu. So this is when in the Brahma Samhita there is this verse that mentions Kshiram Yatha Dadi Vishesha Vikar Yogat, which means kshira, milk, transforms into yogurt. It's a special transformation. So similarly, at that stage, Mahavishnu's special transformation happens, and then that is the glance. Actually, it is mentioned as a halo of the Lord's glance. So Shambhu is that halo of the Lord's glance that carries all the living entities and the time element, and impregnates the material energy, who is none other than Lord Ramadevi's expansion. So in this way, Shambhu assists in the creation of the material elements, and he is the one who actually carries the glands. And neither Ramadevi nor Lord Mahavishnu come in contact with the material elements or with the material nature. So then, when the Lord is, when all the material elements are impregnated and the universes are now created, then the Lord expands himself into each universe as Garbhodakshai Ocean, or as Garbhodakshai Vishnu, and from his body come out a lot of water, and he fills half that, so it's like the universal egg, and he fills lower half of that egg with the water that comes out of his body. So that becomes the Garbhodakshai Ocean, the Garbhodaka Ocean, and he's lying in that ocean. And then also there is another expansion, Kshiro Dakshai Vishnu, the one who enters into each and every atom in the universe. So in this way, Mahavishnu expands into these three different forms. And once this material world is created, then the material energy in the form of Durga Devi, she takes charge of all the material, the living entities in the material world. And the minute the living entities come into the material world, then they are under the influence of three modes of material nature. And then, as Jananivas Prabhu was also mentioning yesterday, then that constantly Durga Devi is jabbing us with the threefold miseries. The threefold miseries, the Adi Devik, Adi Bhautik, and Adi Atmik. So the miseries caused by our own mind, the miseries caused by other living entities, and the miseries caused by the natural calamities, too hot, sometimes it's too cold, sometimes the mosquitoes are biting us. So those kind of things. So these three, so then as Srila Prabhupada says, she does a thankless job of keeping us here, and while we are suffering the results of our karma and keeping up here, and so then also purifying us. In the process, we are all actually on our own spiritual journeys. So in this way, she is in charge of this material creation. So actually, it is said that once Durga Devi or Parvati, she actually became very morose, that she is always a shadow of the Lord. She is never there in the front. So she can never take darshan of the Lord, because she has this thankless task of actually trying to keep all the living entities in this material world. So then Lord Shiva once and then tells her about the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he explains to her that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is going to take birth in this material world to give mercy to all living entities, to give love of Godhead indiscriminately. And he will not try to kill the sinners. He will try to eliminate their sins. He will try to purify us all. So then she decides to meditate. She decides to do tapasya. So she goes to this place in Mayapur, and she performs austerities there for many, many thousands of years. And then Gauranga Mahaprabhu, since he's very compassionate, and of course she has a strong desire to see him, he appears before her, and he's very pleased with her. So her heartfelt desire to see the Lord in that form is fulfilled. So she sees, and then if you go to Mayapur, there is Lord Jagannath's temple in Rajapur. So just behind the altar where the Lord sits, there is another altar where there's a small pond, and there's an altar where Parvati, in the form of Simantini Devi, she's worshipped there as Simantini Devi, after she was blessed by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there is her temple. And just next to her altar is Lord Shiva. So he also resides there. So all three of them are over there, Lord Jagannath and Simantini Devi, as after being blessed by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and then Lord Shiva. So Mahamaya, it is as it is said, she has two forms. Durga or Mahamaya, she has a gentle side to her. So in this gentle side, she is the Annapurna, or she is the mother, Jagadhatri. She provides all the trees, all the vegetation, the fruits and vegetables, and the rivers, the lakes, the minerals, gems and jewelry, whatever we need for our basic necessities provided by Mother Earth. So she's also there in that form. Then she's also there in the violent form, her violent parts like the Kali Devi, the Chandi, you know, the one who kills the demons. So she has these two forms. Now, it is said by the Acharyas that out of all the different aspects, it is the Guru Tattva and the Shiva Tattva. They are very complicated. They are very difficult to understand. Because Lord Shiva, he expands many times. And his name and his residence changes according to the function that he's performing for the Lord. So, as is mentioned in Brahma Samhita, Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj states in the purports to the chapter where there are actually the texts that mention actually where is Devi Dham and there is a Mahesh Dham. So, lowermost realm is the material world, is the Devi Dham. Above him is the Mahesh Dham where Lord Shiva resides, and above him is the Hari Dham, which the start of the spiritual world. But then the Lord resides actually on both sides of Brahma Jyoti, Lord Shiva. So the Sadashiva or the Shambhu aspects, which is the direct manifestation from the Supreme Lord, he is actually in the lower portions of Haridham or the spiritual world. And it is to be noted that when the complete annihilation happens, he does not die, or he doesn't have a post like Lord Brahma. Like Lord Brahma is a post. Anybody who performs austerities for at least 100 lifetimes, if you can live perfectly, you can get Lord Brahma's position. But Lord Shiva is not like that. There is only one person who is Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, because as Lord Vishnu mentions that Lord Shiva is none other than me, myself, in a different. So it is Lord Vishnu in a different flavor. And it is mentioned in the Vayu Purana that Sadashiva is actually the direct expansion of Lord Krishna's form for the sake of all his pastimes. And he is the one who resides in Haridham. And then there is Lord Shiva, and then there is another form, there is another Lord Shiva who resides, but same expansions of the same Shiva, who resides on Mount Kailash. And then in the form of Rudra, he also helps in annihilation. At the time of annihilation, it is said that Rudra, although when at the time of creation, when Lord Brahma actually comes out from the lotus stem, he's sitting on the lotus stem of that comes out of the navel of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. So he's sitting there and then he meditates, and then he's now given the task to procreate, to populate the universe. So then his first expansions are the four Kumaras, but they are very, very learned and they're self-realized. So they do not obey the instructions of their father Brahma, and they said, no, we want to remain brahmacharis, we don't want to get involved in all this creation. So Lord Brahma gets very upset, and then while he's still angry and he's meditating, and from his forehead comes out a reddish, blackish baby. And that is Rudra. So this Rudra is then further expands into 11 more Rudras. And the minute they are born, they start ripping up things, and they start damaging, and they start breaking, they start even attacking Lord Brahma. So Lord Brahma gets a bit worried. He thinks, so I've hardly barely started the process of creation and these fellows are already destroying everything. So he calls the original Rudra and he says, my dear son, you please go and perform austerities. Now is not the time when I need your services, so when I will need you, I will call you. So he, along with the other 11 Rudras, they go away and they perform austerities. But it is said that this Rudra is actually a direct expansion of Sankarshan. So at the time of annihilation, there is no rain. For many, many thousands of years, there is no rain. And then when it comes to a complete end, then from Lord Ananta's mouth, now Lord Ananta Shesha has millions and millions of mouths, and he's singing the glories of Lord with his unlimited mouths. At the time of annihilation, then he starts spewing a lot of fire starts coming out from his from his mouth. So then, and that is the time when Rudra, he starts the Tandav Nritya, the dance of destruction. And then he ultimately orchestrates the entire destruction process. So all the material worlds are then annihilated. And then everything is wound up. The material elements again, they come together. They are again unmanifest, in the unmanifest condition. And the living entities again go back into the body of Mahavishnu. So this is how they not only help Mother Durga and Lord Shiva, in the form of Shambhu, they not only help during the time of creation, but also at the time of destruction. Then Lord in the form of Rudra, he's then helping in the destruction of the universes and to wind up all the material universes. So it is mentioned that the jivas, they have only 50 qualities, like Lord Krishna has 64 qualities and all in full, complete. Jivas only have 50 of them, only in small amounts. And Lord Shiva has those 50 in great amounts, in big amounts. And also 5 more qualities which the jivas do not have, which we material, living entities do not have. And Brahma has also those 50 qualities that we living entities have, and he also has 5 other qualities. But it is said that the quality of divinity is a lot more in Shiva than in Brahma. So to that extent, he is considered even more elevated than Lord Brahma. So Lord Shiva, when it comes to the quality of divinity, he is even considered more elevated than Lord Brahma. So oftentimes it is mentioned, like for example in Ramayana, it is mentioned that Lord Ramchandra, and he is one of the Leela avatars, he worshipped Lord Shiva to get his blessings. So then a lot of devotees, sometimes even as when you're preaching to new people, you get asked this question that in Ramayana, you read Ramayana and you know and talk about it and people... So why not worship Lord Shiva, the Supreme Lord himself, as in his one of his incarnations at Lord Ram, he is worshipping Lord Shiva. So why not worship Lord Shiva, and why not celebrate Shivratri, and why not have him on the altar? So Bhakti Siddhant Saraswati Thakur Maharaj has explained in Siddhant Ratnam, he says that the Supreme Lord himself makes it clear that he comes as Lord Ram, and then he's worshipping Lord Shiva to show a direction to those who cannot take up bhakti. Not everybody can take up to devotional service. Some of them are inclined to dharma, artha, kama, moksha. So to give those people a direction, to give them something on the path of dharma, they're still being dutiful, they're still following the scriptures, but of a lower level. See, bhakti is considered the highest. It is the topmost. But not everybody can take to it. So then the others must also be shown a path. And just as in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna has given us different kinds of yogas. And that gives us the opportunity to us to actually compare. Sometimes you wonder why he gave all these different kinds. He should have just mentioned bhakti yoga. But just so that we can actually compare and we can actually understand which one is the highest. But at the same time, there are people who still can't take up to it, but you could actually appreciate it still. So then in this way, Lord Ram, when the Supreme Lord comes at Lord Ram, then he tries to, those who are after religiosity, economic development, sense gratification and liberation, to show them a path, to show them a way to progress also somehow spiritually, then he actually worships Lord Shiva. And then also there is another argument that is given that Lord Ram had also worshipped the ocean. So does that mean that the ocean god is superior to Lord Ram? So no. So he is actually trying to show how you have to respect, you have to give due respect to a demigod when it is needed, when you actually are offering for some help, from some service from them. So he had to establish a standard. So in this way he, you know, so Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj is saying that's why the Lord comes like this. And he also mentions, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj also mentions that the Lord is, that Rudra is none other than the Lord himself. He is just another flavor of Lord Vishnu. So that's why he's worshipping his own form. But no one is superior to Vishnu or Krishna. He's the absolute and he's the highest. So then there is also, oftentimes you would see that in India that the devotees also sometimes take part in Shivratri. And then there's some controversy as to how much do you take part in Shivratri and what do you do. So it is mentioned that even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu used to go to Lord Shiva's temples during his South India tour. He went there. But to please Lord Shiva, all he did was he chanted the holy names of Lord Krishna. Because Lord Shiva does not want any glories for himself. He's a pure devotee of the Lord and he is completely devoid of any false ego. So then when he went to Bhuvaneshwar, there is a beautiful temple of Lord Shiva there. So he actually chanted the holy names of the Lord and he danced and chanted the names of the Lord. So yes, but then it is mentioned at the same time that these days you may not have any bona fide temples of Lord Shiva where he's actually worshipped as the devotee of Lord Krishna. And you actually may be quite disturbed to see what a lot of things that they do. They're sometimes offering him wine, they're offering him animals, and animal sacrifices and other things. And it could actually be quite disturbing to go to a Shiva temple. You might go there with the mood of worshipping the topmost devotee of the Lord, an exalted Vaishnava. But the way it is done in a lot of Shiva temples is quite different from what the bona fide worship was meant to be. So then we have to always meditate on Lord Shiva, and while now we're chanting the glories of Lord Shiva, we're automatically getting his blessings. So the best way to do is just chant his glories and to hear the pastimes on Shivratri. I think that's the day when he actually drank the poison. So the devotees take bath and they hear the glories of Lord Shiva as to how he has been a great Vaishnava and how he has assisted Lord Krishna in different pastimes of Lord Krishna. So this is what the devotees do on Shivratri or on other days when Lord Shiva is worshipped. So today also happens to be the disappearance day of Narhari Sarkar Thakur. So Narhari Sarkar Thakur was born in Sri Khanda. And when we hear of Narhari Sarkar, actually what comes to the mind is that line in Sandhya Aarti, Narhari Adi Kori Chamara Dulaya. So it is a beautiful, this Sandhya Aarti is actually a beautiful description of how Gauranga Mahaprabhu's Aarti that takes place at the bank of River Ganga in Mayapur. And there's a beautiful description of how he's very nicely being worshipped by his disciples. And then Narhari Sarkar Thakur is actually fanning the Lord with the yak tail, with the chamara. And this is a description of that. And Narhari Sarkar Thakur, it is said, was very prominent. And he was in a part of all the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He was present in almost all the pastimes. And it is said that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is seen as the tree of love of Godhead. So he is the tree who has come to give the fruits and flowers, which are the love of Godhead, pure bhakti, to all the souls of the world. And Narhari Sarkar is one of the major branches. Because Sri Khanda, where he was born, is the place which is like the major branch. And there is Mukunda's son Raghunandan. They're also considered the 39th branch, and he's considered the 40th branch. And on that branch come the fruits and the flowers of pure love of Godhead, which basically means that they have, in a very great way, assisted Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in distributing the love of Godhead, in spreading the glories of the holy names of the Lord everywhere in that area. So it is mentioned that Narhari Sarkar Thakur is actually Madhumati in Braja. And her service, Madhumati's service in the spiritual world is to supply nectarian honey to Radha and Krishna. So one time Lord Nityananda actually goes to Narhari Sarkar, to Sri Khanda, and he says, "Oh, where is that nectarian honey? Now that we know your real identity," of course Lord Nityananda was none other than, you know, Lord Balaram. So Lord Nityananda knows her real identity, and he says, "Oh, so where is that nectarian honey that you've always been serving to Radha and Krishna?" So Narhari Sarkar Thakur goes to a nearby pond and he fills it with water, and then that water turns into the most delicious kind of honey, and he gives that pot to Lord Nityananda and all his associates, and they drink it to their heart's content. So they're completely satisfied after getting the honey that Narhari Sarkar gives to them. It is also mentioned in the Gaura Ganadesh Dipika by Kavi Karnapurna that Sri Radharani's friend Madhumati came as Narhari Sarkar to assist in the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu actually did not like to be glorified. In front of him, you could not glorify him. But Narhari Sarkar Thakur was the only one who would glorify the Lord, who would glorify his beautiful form, his features. You know that song, Ajanulambit, you know that song, he's 7 feet tall, he's got beautiful arms that go up to his knees. So in this way, he used to describe such beautiful, the form of the Lord, and would describe the form of the Lord and how merciful he is. And the Lord would not stop him. But if any other devotee would want to glorify the Lord in front of him, he would block his ears and he would say, "Vishnu, Vishnu." So he wouldn't listen. So that way, Narhari Sarkar was the only one who had the adhikar, who had the right to do Gaura Kirtan, to do Kirtan of the Lord, and then the Lord would actually enjoy it and not, you know, mind it. And he also being, Narhari Sarkar Thakur is also known to be a very great poet. So he has composed beautiful poetry describing the Lord and his pastimes. And he could compose poetry on the spot. He didn't have to, but just looking at the Lord, he could just immediately create poetry for the glorification of the Lord. And Narhari Sarkar Thakur had a disciple called Lochindas Thakur. And Lochindas Thakur has written Chaitanya Mangal. So Lochindas Thakur mentions in Chaitanya Mangal that my guru, Sri Narhari Sarkar Thakur, is actually so absorbed in Krishna that his body is nothing else. His mind is nothing else but just complete meditation on the Supreme Lord, Krishna. So such is the glorious pastime of Narhari Sarkar. He is one of the associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu who came to assist in his efforts to spread the holy name of the Lord in this world. And he has helped him, and he has been a part of that. And he is actually none other than one of the dear friends of Srimati Radharani from the spiritual world. So, yeah, I think I'll end here now. If you have any questions, comments, corrections. Yes, Prabhupada.
Even though Lord Shiva is recognized as the greatest Vaishnava, in ISKCON, we don't worship Lord Shiva.
Yeah.
So what reasons do you think there might be for that?
Why we don't worship Lord Shiva is because Srila Prabhupada has clearly mentioned that we do not need to worship any of the demigods, including Lord Shiva. And as is mentioned also in Bhagavatam, yatra taror mulena nishachanena. So just as when we water the root of a tree, the twigs, branches and the leaves, they get enlivened, they get energized. So similarly, when we worship Lord Krishna, he's a supreme personality of Godhead, then all the demigods, they automatically become satisfied. So there is no need to worship any of the demigods at all separately, because Krishna says they are, you satisfy me, and they are automatically, all of them are automatically satisfied. You know better than me, Prabhuji. I think you should answer that.
It's just that you mentioned that, you know, we can worship Lord Shiva or Shiva Ratri, but we just don't do that.
No, not in the sense that we actually worship him. We just chant the holy names of Krishna, and that's how he's satisfied. So we are getting the blessings of a pure Vaishnava by chanting the holy names of the Lord on the day of Shivaratri.
Any day for that matter.
Yeah.
It's just that, you know, on that particular day we don't do anything different. So.
Yeah. But what happens is, unfortunately, in India, because the rest of the population is just so involved, so then some of the devotees tend to question, what do we do? So then that's what is instructed, that Srila Prabhupada said, that you don't worship them separately. You just chant the holy names of the Lord, and you chant more if you want to. You chant more on that day, and Lord Shiva will be very pleased with you because you're chanting the holy names of Krishna, and then you get his blessings in that way.
So we don't do anything different?
No.
Mm-hmm. Lord Shiva's a devotee, and he's most satisfied when Krishna's being glorified.
Yeah.
On any day.
Yeah.
What a speaker. And one of the problems with worshipping Lord Shiva is that many people think that he's God. Mm. And yet
it's a misconception.
Why we don't worship the demigods.
Mm.
Because ultimately, worship of Krishna satisfies all of those requirements.
Yeah.
And sometimes people come to the temple and they say, you know, where's Lord Shiva, where's Ganesh, you know, where's...
That's why Srila Prabhupada writes in that purport in which he mentions that, you know, Lord, that you just as you water the root of the tree. And also just as we feed the stomach, you know, we don't need to feed our fingers separately. So you eat and then all the bodily senses are satisfied, and just as we water the root of the tree, all the demigods, or the trees, all the leaves, twigs, branches are satisfied. So similarly, Krishna clearly says that when you worship me, then all the demigods are automatically satisfied. They're not... No individual worship is needed. And Srila Prabhupada, I think, has mentioned time and again, many places in Bhagavatam, that demigod worship is not required. So don't take a detour, don't take a longer route. Do a direct service to the Supreme Lord.
Also, it's mentioned that the worship of the spiritual master, the spiritual master is the sum total of all the demigods.
Yeah.
If you're worshiping the spiritual master, then you're worshiping the representatives, the representative of God.
Of
course, the demigods are also God's representatives, and when you worship the spiritual master, then automatically you're fulfilling that requirement of worshiping
the
representatives of God, of whom the demigods are prominent personalities, but simply by worshiping them.
The spiritual master. Satisfies all demigods.
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Because sometimes people will think, oh, we're committing offense, we didn't worship this one, that one.
Mm-hmm.
You
know,
actually, just by worshiping Srila Prabhupada, they will automatically worship you.
Easy. Yeah, okay, Prabhupada. Yeah. Anything else? Yes.
Well, you say that Daksha is criticizing Lord Shiva,
mm-hmm,
because he's looking at a bodily platform.
Yes.
But it looks like Sati is also doing the same thing now. She's considering my body is from your body, so she's also on a bodily platform.
Although she's saying this, but she's an eternal consort of Lord Shiva. And okay, I mean, she is saying this also because, after all, we do have a material body. She did have a material body, and the fact is that she was a daughter of Daksha. So, and then here, the question is not so much of being on the material body. It is the fact that Daksha was criticizing a devotee. That is such an exalted devotee. That's why she was saying all these things. She was not saying these things. Yes, you're right. I mean, you can say, oh, because first Daksha criticized, then now Sati is criticizing Daksha. But then Sati is not criticizing out of envy. She is not criticizing out of anger. She has actually very politely first put to her father the arguments that that my husband, Lord Shiva, has no enemies. He's faultless, you see. And then she also explained that you are finding faults in a person who is faultless. So it's so you see, all these arguments are valid arguments, and none of them seem to have come out of anger or envy. Sati does not have any anger or envy towards her father. But she is right, as Srila Prabhupada says, her behavior is exemplary, because she's actually defending a devotee. She's actually speaking against blasphemy of a devotee, that were an exalted devotee like Lord Shiva. So the criticism is definitely not recommended, but when it is, you have to defend a Vaishnava when he's being blasphemed, then you must defend. And she was actually first instructing. So the point where which makes her different from Daksha is that she is not speaking out of envy, she is not speaking out of anger, and she is not trying to belittle Daksha. You see, her motive is just to reiterate the exalted position of Lord Shiva to her father Daksha. That was the only motive she had. That's why it is different from Daksha's criticism.
Even if her body was not, even if she wasn't the daughter of Daksha, mm-hmm. she was the same
thing. Yes, but the relationship makes her feel a bit difficult. Yeah, she would. Yes, one should do the same thing, but the fact that she's the daughter of Daksha, that makes her even more miserable. Yes, Ruby.
Daksha's criticizing the external features of Lord Shiva without understanding his internal
mood.
Yeah. His motivations.
Mm-hmm.
Sati is pointing out the fault in her father's mood or motivation.
Yeah.
In that, and so therefore she's describing the mood or the behaviour of Daksha, which is inappropriate.
Mm. Yeah.
And as you say, it's a criticism of Lord Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
So, Daksha's missing the point.
Yeah.
He's missing the point, and he's criticizing the person unnecessarily. Mm. There's no fault, actually. He's finding fault. So he has a fault-finding mentality.
Yeah.
And so, Sati's able to see that internal mood of both, whereas Daksha's not able to see the internal of Lord Shiva. So there's a difference between the two.
Yeah. Mm.
In that Sati's able to see the subtle, the devotee's able to usually see the subtle implications, or not the subtle implications, but the other implications.
Mm-hmm.
And the subtle motivations of others.
Yeah.
And so she's, and one can rightfully point out the fault in those characteristics of the person if they're improper.
Mm.
That's actually not criticism.
Just pointing out, just correcting somebody is not finding faults. Yeah.
And Rupa Goswami recommends that we actually do that.
Mm-hmm.
That we need to, you know, not everybody is equal.
Yeah.
Okay, so usually we're equal, but at the same time there's differences. And Rupa Goswami recommends that we are able to identify the differences between and in fact, that's the position of a bunch of Bhakta, intermediate devotee. They can recognize the difference between them and the devotee, first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
And And the reason is because they avoid the association of demoniac people because they're so critical and that association is so destructive. Association is so powerful.
Yeah.
Which is why Judy Russell was worried about, you know, what are his sons going to do on the battlefield, etc. Yeah. You know, they've got the association of the demoniac people. We would be careful. So likewise, we discriminate between devotees and non-devotees. And even within the devotees, we identify who's a beginner, who's an intermediate, who's advanced. So that's called discrimination, not criticism.
Yeah.
And so when a person points out differences, that's not being critical necessarily. It may be, but generally it's not. When the observations are detached or devoid of that critical mentality.
Sure.
So we expect that from devotees, actually.
To be able to discriminate.
You don't go embrace a tiger and say, "Yeah, we're all one." He's looking at you as his breakfast.
Sure enough.
So sometimes people think the devotees are being critical, but actually they're just using their power of discrimination to identify good association and bad association and want to associate with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, she's so detached from that. Because normally a daughter is affectionate and respectful of their father.
Yeah.
But she's so detached from his misbehaviour that she renounces a whole lot.
Yeah, she just wants to give up her life. Yeah. Person, yeah.
It's quite amazing, really, when you think about it.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Prabhuji. Anybody else? Thank you. Granth Raj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.